Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. This Sunday, November 12th, 2006. I'm Bob McChesney, coming to you from the studio of WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a live show for you today. It was just about 20 years ago today that Ronald Reagan was president. One of the television networks, I believe ABC, put a program on the air called America about a Soviet invasion of the United States. And a group was formed, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, to take on the mainstream media and to expose what it regarded as the weaknesses, flaws, and biases. 20 years later, it's going strong, and today on Media Matters, we're going to be privileged to have two of its long-standing members, Janine Jackson and Steve Rendell, here to talk about what's going on in the news today, to talk about FAIR, and answer your questions. So join us today, but first, Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A shift in the congressional balance of power means the fight for media reform in Washington, D.C. gains more momentum. So says Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott, who believes knock-on effects from larger issues like the war in Iraq will positively change the dynamic of debate over issues of media policy. Scott believes the environment to promote media democracy is dramatically more hopeful, but it still won't be easy.
The Republicans, of course, still hold the votes to block anything from getting through the Senate, and that will require bipartisan coalitions to pass any piece of legislation. And I suspect the White House will finally discover it owns a veto pen.
One of the most fundamental changes affecting the legislation of media policy is control over the key committees who deal with media and telecommunications-related issues.
Changing who's got the gavel in their hand is enormously influential. It allows the Democrats to set the agenda of what issues will be considered. It allows them to draft the legislation that will be put forward. It allows them to set the terms of the debate and who will work in what coalitions.
The outgoing Republican majority still has a chance to ram through changes to law in a so-called lame duck session of Congress, where business is done between now and the time new representatives and senators can be sworn in. Such sessions often result in windfalls to special interests who've paid big money to support outgoing politicians, but Scott doesn't think that will happen on the telecom front.
I do not expect major telecommunications legislation to pass in the lame duck. I would be shocked if it did. The Democrats have zero incentive to allow a lame duck Republican majority to pass a big telecom bill when they know their guys are going to have a fresh crack at it come 2007.
The change of party in power on Capitol Hill should also chill the Federal Communications Commission's drive to modify rules like those regulating media ownership in the direction of industry-favored changes.
I think the oversight power that the Democrats now have will play a major role in disciplining the behavior of some of the more recalcitrant federal agencies that have operated pretty much with impunity for the last several years.
Though Democrats may now hold the statistical upper hand, it remains to be seen how they will use their newfound power to foster improvements to the U.S. media environment. Scott's identified at least three major areas where big battles may loom.
We have a lot of ideas about how we can solve our broadband problems. We desperately need to catch up with the rest of the world in broadband. We're going to be working a lot on media ownership. We strongly believe that localism and diversity are under siege at the FCC, really, with their latest round of media consolidation proposals. And we also think that this is a really good opportunity for public broadcasting to come back on the agenda and to really reinvent public media as a 21st century media system that addresses the needs and desires of the American public.
The FCC has yet again delayed a vote on the approval of an $80 billion merger between AT&T and Bell South. This is in large part due to the decision of Republican Commissioner Robert McDowell to recuse himself from the vote, given his past history as a lobbyist for small independent phone companies. This leaves the FCC with a 2-2 split. Democratic members Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps will not vote to approve the merger unless significant safeguards for consumers are added to the deal, including a meaningful provision to protect the principle of network neutrality online. However, there is speculation that FCC Chairman Kevin Martin may order McDowell to vote on the merger, which would potentially break the deadlock. But this is less likely now that the balance of party power has shifted in Congress, where the incoming Democratic chairman of key telecom-related committees are calling on the FCC to carefully consider the implications of a more powerful Ma Bell, which would control more than half the nation's telephone network infrastructure. Forcing McDowell to vote might also open the door to lawsuits challenging the merger on conflict of interest grounds. The FCC's next regular business meeting is scheduled for December 14th.
And a quick reminder to register for the 3rd National Conference for Media Reform, organized by Free Press and scheduled to take place from January 12th through the 14th in Memphis, Tennessee. Join thousands of concerned citizens, journalists, policymakers, scholars, and celebrities to celebrate and strategize for media reform. Early bird conference registration rates have been extended through November 17th. Visit www.freepress.net/conference to learn more and make plans to be there. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, Sunday, November 12th, 2006. I'm in the studios of WILL-AM in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, in a lovely fall afternoon. Today we have a program I've been anticipating for a long time. I think it was back when we started Media Matters, four and a half years ago, that our first or second guest, if I recall, was one of our guests today. Because I thought the group that she works for, and the group we'll be talking about today, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, did such commendable work, and I knew that it did such great work that our listeners would enjoy hearing her talk. And today we have her joining us, Janine Jackson, FAIRS Program Director and frequent contributor to FAIRS Magazine Extra, is on the line with us. She's also, as many of you probably know, the co-host and producer of the show Counterspin, which is aired here on WILL Wednesday nights at 10:30 and also over on WEFT. On Mondays at 5:30. Janine, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
We also have your running mate, Steve Rendell, FAIRS Senior Analyst, another co-host and co-producer of Counterspin, and author of books, including The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error, published by the New Press, and someone who's just done an immense amount of research. He's received rewards from Project Censored, one of the really smart people about how media work in our society. Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you, Bob.
Well, it's having both of you here. I know we're going to have a lot of callers who want to talk about press coverage because FAIRS is really sort of the gold standard for media analysis in many respects, certainly of journalism. The big news, of course, has been the election on Tuesday. What were your thoughts of how the press, the mainstream press, has been covering the outcome of the election since starting Tuesday? Janine, you can go first.
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing that I think of is how similar it looks to how they cover every other election. I mean, we always talk about how no matter what happens, the media seem to, the elite media anyway, seem to draw the lesson that everyone should move to the right, or for Democrats, move to the center. That seems to be the wisdom that gets pulled out of elections no matter what happens. And here we have it again. We have mainstream media telling us that the reason Democrats were successful in this election is because, you know, they weren't really liberal. They were so moderate, you know, and it tells you more about really the way media work and the philosophy of the people who run the media and who speak on the media much more than it does really about the political landscape in the country.
Well, the Washington Post today, Bob, says, quote, "The majority party that takes control of the House and Senate in January will look significantly different from the party that was swept to power in the 1994 elections. The old guard liberals swept from power."
Yeah.
In the 1994 election, the old guard liberals and staunch union supporters in control then are giving way to a new generation of moderates with more temperate legislative ambitions. And today's New York Times, very similarly, has this front page piece that says the incoming Democrats are non-ideological populists. And it goes on to say, admit, that Democrats won over concerns including access to affordable health care, an exit strategy for Iraq, the loss of manufacturing jobs, and, quote, growing anxieties among voters about a global economy that no longer seems to work for them, close quote. Now, it seems to us, if the Times is arguing that these issues are no longer controversial or ideological, but are sort of agreed on matters of national interest, that that itself would be a huge victory for progressives. But of course, the Times is not doing that. They're just using this whole thing to try to whip Democrats to the center, to try to remind them to shun their Democratic Party base. And this has been just such a huge effort in recent years. And as Janine said, this sort of reflects the center-right preference of our media, I think expressed best in the 2004 election by Sumner Redstone, who some of your listeners will know, gave a very candid chat where he talked about what a great guy John Kerry was, a great dignified man, a war hero, and all that. But Sumner Redstone said, in the end, Republicans are just much better for the media business. So they had to go with the go with Bush in the 2004 election.
Now, Janine Jackson, I followed the races very closely, and I was just waiting for the exact evidence that was to lead us to believe the current crop of Democratic victors in the Senate races, for example, which I knew all of them, was somehow significantly more conservative than the crop in any previous year. I mean, I'm not saying that's not necessarily the case, but I didn't see the evidence. Was there any evidence put forward for this claim?
Well, you know, not that I could see. Some of it had to do with the style of haircut they wore. And
You speaking specifically John Tester here?
I am indeed. You know, there was some back and forth over whether that was a flat top or a crew cut, you know, and that was kind of what we got for analysis. No, it's been on that superficial level. And, of course, you can point to one candidate here or there who is anti-abortion rights or something like that. But what you didn't see was really an adding up of the numbers, a talking of candidates about what they themselves felt led to their victories, what they thought constituents were voting for. You know, we mainly saw, again, this kind of philosophy, media philosophy imposed on reality, even though, as in this case, it quite clearly doesn't fit.
Yes. And Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown are arguably, these are two incoming new senators. One, Bernie Sanders, is an independent socialist, and Sherrod Brown is definitely a Democrat. These are arguably the most progressive people in the Senate, and they're brand new.
And if I'm not mistaken, Bernie Sanders won with an enormous landslide over the richest person in the state of Vermont, in a state that at the same time Sanders was elected a Republican governor in the same election on Tuesday.
That's right.
So it was
exactly.
Hardly like he was elected in the Soviet of Leningrad in 1917.
Well, and it makes the point that, you know, you can pull a trend from wherever you choose. If you want to talk about that as the most as an interesting aspect in this election, you have a valid reason for doing so. It just shows how much of this really is left up to the judgment of reporters to decide what's a trend to talk about, what's a phenomenon that's valuable to kind of lift out of the mass and put on the news night after night, like, for example, values voters or moral values in the last election, what turned out to be one kind of small poll question with a very arguable and vague response to it. But for media, that became the storyline, and that's what so often happens. There's a storyline, and that gets pressed through no matter what.
However you argue it, you know, this election was won over two main issues of the war and trade and
exactly.
globalization with some, and the Times piece today even acknowledges that. It says that these were the issues that these non-ideological people won over. But also there's really an untold story about how Latino and Asian voters played into this.
Right.
They switched in large numbers to the Democrats after having voted in much large numbers for Republicans in 2004. And that means, what's that about? It seems fairly evident that it's about a lot of this reactionary rhetoric around immigration that's come largely from the GOP, but unfortunately from some Democrats, too.
Well, you know, one of the issues that was made on Tuesday night and that came through the electoral season was that the Republican Party, for the first time in my memory, ran several African-American candidates for statewide office, a governor in Pennsylvania and Ohio, senator in Maryland. Yet at the same time, non-white populations in the United States seemed to gird their vote for the Democrats. If anything, the Republican Party became more of a party of white voters, for lack of a better term.
Well, all those candidates lost, didn't they?
They all lost.
I think Deval Patrick was a Democrat, of course, in Massachusetts won, but not. I think all the Republicans lost.
I'd like to point to that as an example of people starting to see through, you know, starting to check the reality against the image, you know, the idea that the Republican Party is, by and large, a good one for African Americans is maybe voters are starting to see through that a little bit. Certainly the media love to pick up on the story of black Republicans because it seems like a kind of, you know, man bites dog, you know, so they often get a kind of elevated place in the public consciousness. Maybe they just don't have that same role in the black community.
Our guests today on Media Matters, Janine Jackson, who you just heard, and Steve Rendell, they are both workers at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group based out of New York. Janine Jackson is Fairness Program Director and writes frequently for Extra. Steve Rendell also writes for Extra, but he's their senior analyst, and they are both co-hosts and producers of Counterspin, the terrific weekly program they do with Peter Hart. Counterspin can be heard right here on WILL AM 580. Every Wednesday night at 10:30, it's also available on our local sister community station, WEFT, Monday at 5:30. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Steve and Janine, the number here at WILL is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We've been talking about the press coverage of the election, and I want to talk a little bit more about that on today's show, but do not think for a second that's the only thing Steve and Janine can talk about with authority. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the group they work for, which has been in existence for 20 years, is a media watch group that covers the full range of journalism and news coverage. It covers, does detailed studies of public broadcasting. There are very few topics they can't speak about with authority and make very provocative points. So do call in with your questions and comments. On that note, let's go to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that Counterspin is my second most favorite radio program I've seen here, and the podcast also I really appreciate.
Oh, thank
you. I wanted to ask you, there was this underreported story about the effort by the CWA and friends to purchase the Philadelphia Inquirer. So there's just a little bit in the press, and then it seemed to disappear, and I lost the thread. I wondered if you could tell us what happened with that, and maybe more generally, efforts by, you know, more enlightened folks to capture through purchase some of the big city dailies or other major media. And I'll hang up and take your answer. Thanks.
Yeah, and before Steve and Jeannie answer that, because I've got a feeling that's got a Counterspin show forthcoming on this topic, is there was also the piece in the L.A. Times, I believe, yesterday by one of the heirs to the Chandler fortune, I think Harry Chandler, where he said that they should basically have municipal ownership of daily newspapers, and he offered up the L.A. Times as Exhibit A. I don't know if you saw that piece yet.
Didn't see it.
Yeah.
I have not seen that. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I thought it would get your attention. I mean, you've been dealing and wrestling with the implications of chain ownership on newspaper journalism and sort of corporate ownership. And the caller asked about the effort that didn't get a lot of publicity of the Newspaper Guild, the Print Journalists Union, to lead a consortium to purchase several major daily newspapers, including the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Right.
Have you followed that, and what's your take on this whole situation?
Well, we did follow that. In fact, it wasn't just the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was after Knight Ritter sold out to McClatchy. McClatchy picked and chose the papers that it wanted, and Knight Ritter sort of sold piecemeal those other papers. At some point, there was some question that the Newspaper Guild, along with the CWA, the Communication Workers of America, would come in and buy all or some part of those papers. That story received very little coverage, and I'm not really sure what happened behind the scenes. In the end, most of the papers were sold in piecemeal, including the one, the Philadelphia Inquirer, was, of course, sold to a local developer and rich man in Philadelphia. That's what I know about it. That's about it.
Yeah, and that's more than I know. I mean, I only can speak broadly to the trend, which I think is certainly shaking things up in a way that's interesting. Certainly one of the things that Fair talks about is the significance of ownership, you know, of who owns the outlet on what gets done there. I think, but it's always important to keep in mind that it's not always a question of substituting a better corporation anyway for another corporation. You really have to look at the structure, you know, the ownership structure, how decisions are made and all of that. So certainly, you know, it's fascinating to see in unions in particular. That's something many people have been calling for years, to actually get ownership of the outlets that they work for and that they produce the value for. I think it's a fascinating trend that we're certainly going to be watching.
It's good to have. It's good. Localism has its advantages, and it can be good, but it doesn't necessarily have to be good because it comes with a lot of new problems, and that is, as in Philadelphia, where the person that bought the Philadelphia Inquirer is a real mover and shaker in town and has a lot of connections and a lot of potential for conflicts of interest there.
Well, I referred earlier to the LA Times in the setup to this question.
Right.
And, of course, I know that FAIR has been following closely the sort of newsroom and boardroom battles between the Chicago Tribune and LA Times. Do you know what the status of that is now, Janine?
I don't. I wonder if Steve does. I mean, I don't know what the current...
A little bit.
I
know they just fired their editor, and they've lost a publisher a short time ago, and they moved in a publisher who was more of a company man from Chicago, from the Tribune Company, was moved in to head up the L.A. Times, and shortly after that, just last week or the week before, Dean Beckett was fired. He was considered just not enough of a company man for the Tribune Company, I guess.
And folks will know that it sounds very reminiscent of, you know, Jay Harris leaving the San Jose Mercury Tribune years ago. These are people who, in the case of the publisher anyway, are sort of saying, you're asking me, you, the boardroom, are asking me to cut and cut and cut and, you know, cut costs, and I'm simply not going to be able to produce a quality paper doing that. You know, so we're really seeing a kind of head-to-head, the conflict between sort of profit-driven values and the values of journalism.
And I think in the case both of Jay Harris and the current case of the LA Times, it was clear that both papers were actually generating very healthy profits. The cuts that were being asked for were simply to gouge it in the short term.
Well, that's exactly what the whole Knight Ridder sale was about, too. Knight Ridder was making 20%, maybe slightly more than 20% profit, which 20 or 30 years ago in the corporate culture of the United States would have been considered just rip-roaring, a very good profit. But as Ben Bagdikian said when he appeared on our show earlier this year to talk about that, Wall Street doesn't like newspapers. Wall Street wants to see 30, 40% profits like they can often see in television. They're antagonistic towards those smaller profits that newspapers get, even though in the past those would have been considered large profits.
And as Molly Ivins, I recently read a quote where she said she's tired of being asked, does she mind being in a dying industry, talking about the newspaper industry. She said, no, I mind being in an industry that's committing suicide. In other words, you know, the idea that the owners of newspapers are accepting these Wall Street values. They aren't pushing back. They aren't saying, no, you know, you've got enough profit at 20% and we need to produce something of value that people want to buy. Their response has instead been to turn around and gouge and gouge and cut and cut. And that, of course, reduces the value, reduces the quality of the product, if you will, that they're trying to sell.
Our guests today, Janine Jackson and Steve Rendell, they're probably familiar voices to many of you because they are the co-host and producers of the program Counterspin, heard right here on WILL AM 580 Wednesday nights at 10:30, also heard on our sister community station, WEFT, here in Champaign, Mondays at 5:30. They both work for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I think are well-known in that regard. They contribute to their magazine, Extra. And if you're not currently a member of their mailing list, I urge you to go to fair.org, the website, sign up and get their blasts, which they send out periodically, which are their FAIR alerts on breaking stories. They're very informative, and I strongly urge folks to get involved with this. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I want to get back to the phone lines in a second, but I want to close up our election coverage, if I can, Janine, which is the point you were making about how the mainstream media has this interpretation, which invariably falls in one way, of these election results. And in this case, it's always like this was not a mandate for change, but rather a mandate for the Democrats to keep moving to the right. And this is what that establishes. Does this stuff work? I mean, do Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and Howard Dean and the people atop the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, are they going back and watching the news coverage? Say, gosh, you know, I guess that's what this really means. We've really got to, you know, buckle down here and be conservative.
I think it absolutely has an effect, an undeniable effect on politicians to misread the Washington Post and the New York Times as public opinion and to respond to it in rhetoric and in policy as well, to respond to media's rather than the public's interpretation of what is a popular policy, what is a popular position. I also think, unfortunately, very unfortunately, it can have an effect on the public. You know, you think you were, you know, you were voting about the war, and then day after day you hear media that tell you, no, that wasn't what the election was about. I think a lot of us have a built-in resistance to that. You know, we have other ways of getting information that tell us, you know, really what is the pulse of the community, what do people really care about. But for many people who are trying to become active or activists, that media drumbeat can really be deafening and can really be disheartening when you've got a paper telling you, oh, people don't care about health care, really. People don't care about the war, really. Nobody is thinking about impeaching George W. Bush. You know, it can kind of give you the feeling that maybe you're losing it a little bit. And one of the things that FAIR aims to do, you know, the most popular email that we get or message that we get is, thank you, now I know I'm not crazy. You know, now I recognize that this actually is a media storyline, and it doesn't fit with the reality that we're seeing around us in our neighborhoods and communities.
Yeah, you know, I just had dinner last night with a friend of mine in Madison, a very smart political observer, and he said he was just writing a piece himself for publication on just how the Democratic Party's gotten so much more conservative with this election. And I just queried, well, what's the evidence? And he admitted, when I didn't take much questioning, that he really didn't have any evidence. It was just sort of what he'd heard, so he assumed it was true.
Yeah, and when you think about all how the many ways that works, it means when you're trying to write the piece that says, hey, you know, what I found interesting in this election was an upsurge in progressive ideas. I found, you know, the anti-war vote to be really important. You're going to have editors who, with the same lack of reason, say, you know, that doesn't sound to me like the right story. You know, we're not going to carry that because that doesn't ring, you know, that's not what's being said. And so maybe that's a controversial, you know, wacko opinion. So it has very much a self-perpetuating effect.
Our guests, Steve Rendle, Janine Jackson, you've just heard from FAIR. If you'd like to call into Media Matters, the phone number again, 333-9455, toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone line right now. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. A little bit more on the electoral spin. It seems to me that if we knew more about Rahm Emanuel's role in Illinois, Henry Hyde's seat was contested very well by an anti-war candidate the last time. And they forced her out in a primary challenge and put in a woman who was a Gulf War vet, and she lost miserably. And while Rahm Emanuel is being hailed as some kind of champion, he actually lost that one, and it's because he was putting in these people that are, quote-unquote, more moderate. So it's sort of, if you don't report that part of the story, then this moderating Democratic Party is seen to be reflecting the party and not the constituency, if you get my drift.
Yeah, I think one of the big themes, media themes, establishment media themes that's come out of the election is that it was more conservative Democrats who won, and that victory was engineered, that term is used in one piece after another, by Rahm Emanuel, the more or less centrist, behind-the-scenes Democratic strategist and member of Congress from Illinois. And as John Nichols, Bob, your collaborator, appearing on Counterspin just this past week, pointed out, and I think the caller was referring to, Tammy Duckworth, the one candidate that Rahm Emanuel managed to put a couple of million dollars behind, and who you could never quite tell whether or not she was for or against the war. Sometimes she made different sounds at different times, lost. And in fact, as John Nichols pointed out, there were several Democrats who won, who Rahm Emanuel wouldn't even talk to, who he kept at arm's distance. So the idea that Rahm Emanuel engineered this is another media myth that we tried to dispel on our last show.
You know, one of the things, and Jeanine, you referred to John Tester earlier. He was referred to numerous occasions on Tuesday night and since then as a conservative Democrat based, I guess, on his haircut or the fact that he lived on a ranch and that he had a dog and he had a gun. But it, you know, I just wondered, did anyone actually look at his positions? Because from what I could tell of his positions on issue after issue, he would fall pretty firmly in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
That's right. You know, one of his opponent accused him of wanting to change the Patriot Act, and he said, "I don't want to change it. I want to remove it from the books."
Mm-hmm.
And he's a proponent of national health care. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, no. You have more concrete on that. I mean, to me, it only encourages the sort of lowest opinion of particularly television media, where they're really looking at a picture and where they really can't go deeper than this is a man with short hair holding a gun, you know, and it's such a disservice. It shows the incredible shallowness of the media, even when they are supposedly... This is the story, the election, you know, and these people's positions. They still, in all the hours they have, they still simply repeat the same sound bites instead of taking that time to actually look at something quite simple, which is someone's voting record.
Our guests today, Jeanine Jackson, Steve Rendell from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Phone lines are open at 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We got an email in from a caller on the issue of election fraud. And one of the caller makes the point in the email that pundits now seem to have decided that election fraud, vote rigging is a thing of the past. This election sort of solved that. I know that you at FAIR have been covering this issue for the last year or so pretty closely. What was your take of the press coverage of the issue of flawed elections, and where does the matter stand now?
Well, it's my impression that media did an even just stronger version of what they've done in 2004 and 2000, which is to sort of play the role of calming agent, you know, of the institution must stand, even when there are these questions that are obviously getting at the very heart of our democracy, which is access to voting, you know, and to voting rights. And people, what we saw again, you know, we got one site from National Public Radio where they they were saying all during Election Day, boy, this is going so smoothly, and at one point saying so much more smoothly than in 2004. Well, that must have shocked the NPR listeners who'd never really heard very much about any problems at the polls in 2004, because NPR, like other outlets, was busy telling people that there were flare-ups, there were problems here and there, but certainly there was nothing systemic. There was nothing as widespread as it would be to really call for a serious response.
Steve Rendell, there was I just wanted to interject because there was a story that FAIR really broke this week concerning 90 major advertisers effectively saying they wanted to make sure that Air America didn't get any of their ad dollars. And it was an extraordinary story that came out. I guess it was last week at this point. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and let me just say that Media Matters actually beat us by about an hour and a half.
Well, you were it was a team effort.
But what happened was Jeff Cohen had appeared on Peter B. Collins' show. That's a progressive show on the West Coast coming out of Monterey, California. And while he was on there, Peter B. Collins told him about a list he had seen, a list of 90 sponsors, including many of the biggest, most powerful, most well-known corporations in the United States.
Oh, yeah, it's a who's who.
It was a memo from ABC Radio Networks, which is a syndicator of ABC shows, to all kinds of stations. But it was a memo to ABC Radio Network affiliates telling them that on the shows that they aired that were syndicated shows of Air America, some of these ABC radio stations air Air America shows, that no advertising from these 90 sponsors should be aired on there. And it appeared to be, we're not exactly sure what it is, it appeared to be a blacklist. It appeared to be that Air America programming was being blacklisted from these 90 major sponsors. We're still looking into it, and I know that there's other people looking into it. Air America has been a little bit skittish, I'd say sheepish, in responding. I'm afraid they won't. They're not really fighting back, which I wish they would do. But that's about what we know about it.
Well, it's an extraordinary statement. Our guests today, Jeanine Jackson, Steve Rendell, you've just heard from FAIR. We've got a couple callers patiently waiting to talk to them about the news media today, the press coverage we're getting. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line right now. Line 4, Bloomington Normal, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a big supporter of FAIR, but I think if FAIR were reviewing your commentary on the election, I think FAIR would consider it unbalanced and a little distorted. There were some Democrats elected who are conservative. Besides Tester, who is against gun control, you have Casey in Pennsylvania, who is against choice. You have Webb in Virginia, who was in the Reagan administration, and so on. And there were many House candidates, Democrats, who were elected who are fairly conservative. As far as the media saying that the war was not an issue, I haven't heard that at all. Every media outlet I've watched said that the war was the issue, including Tim Russert this morning on Meet the Press confronting McCain, saying the war was the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I think your analysis here is a little bit unbalanced.
Okay, well, let's let our caller, Steve and Janine, respond.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that Webb has moved to the left since he worked for the Reagan administration. But I find the most interesting thing, first of all, gun control has not been a big issue for Democrats for about 10 years, since the middle of the Clinton administration. Tester was against the war. He is for national health care. He opposes the Patriot Act. To put him forth as a conservative Democrat is just not accurate.
Well, actually, he referred to Casey and Webb, the
yeah.
caller did.
Oh, I thought he mentioned Tester, too. No. But Casey is the most interesting case.
Well,
People vote for Casey because he was against choice? Because, actually, if that was all they cared about, they could have voted for Rick Santorum, because he's even more against choice. I think Casey is a pro-union. To say that he's a conservative Democrat based on one issue, I think, is simplifying the matter.
In fact, if I can interject, Steve, a friend of mine who's worked on Capitol Hill and knows Casey from politics says that Casey's, in effect, a socialist in terms of class issues.
Yeah, well, that's what I know he has a long association with union activism and with supporting unions. So I think one can go too far. Let me say this about the caller. I think one can go too far in presenting this as a great progressive victory. But these elections were certainly a clear repudiation of GOP policy, and the winning issues were the war and trade. I don't think nobody said that the war played a key role in this election. I think what happens is they're trying to have the media are trying to say, they're admitting that at one turn and then claiming that the war really isn't an ideological issue.
I think also, first, I did acknowledge that there were some more conservative or accurately described Democrats who had won. I think that they were not enough to generate the sole phenomenon to be discussed out of the elite media, which is kind of what we saw happen right after the election. That was the news, you know, and I didn't think the number of Democrats who went in who could be described as more moderate justified that. On the question also of the war, you can always hear it in two broad strokes, and we want to be careful, you know, not to be lazy in that way. Media are very rarely all one way or all another. There are always exceptions. Again, though, we have a dominant storyline coming out of this election, which is this in sweep of conservative Democrats are going to not fit with. There's going to be conflict with the leadership, which is so wackadoo against the war and for impeachment and this kind of angle. There's been a feeling that the important thing about this new influx of politicians is the way they aren't really, you know, running on these kinds of issues, you know. So it's not that they say war is not an issue for people, but there has been a line that's, you know, the net roots have been a problem. The online networks that care so much about the war, that they've been a problem for the Democratic Party. There's been a kind of poo-pooing of anti-war activists and their influence on the Democratic Party that's been going on for months and months up to and through the election.
It strikes me, as just adding my own observation, that if one looks at the Democratic Party today in Congress and the Democratic Party of 8, 10, 12 years ago, perhaps the most striking difference is that the South is now entirely Republican in the U.S. Senate, with only one or two exceptions for the 12 Dixie states. And that used to be 10 or 12, 14 years ago, there were 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 Democrats in those states. And they were not always, but usually the most conservative Democrats in the U.S. Senate. And that's true on the House side as well. So if you just look at the regional factor, it seems like you could make a pretty decent case that the Democratic Party today is more progressive than it was 10 or 12 years ago, at least the people who actually won election and are serving in Washington. Our guests today, Steve Rendell, Janine Jackson. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, throwing in periodic guest editorials here. And if you'd like to call in, our number at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a full bank of phone lines to go to, so let's get right back at it. Line 1, Coles County, you're on the air.
Yes, I thought I would mention that I agree that John Tester is a progressive, a leftist, and I'm happy that he won. But this is the typical mindset, not only of the media, but the typical mindset of many progressives throughout the country, is that someone who is against gun control, against much stronger gun control, can't possibly be a liberal, let alone a progressive. It's simply out of the question. I mean, if you're a supporter of the Second Amendment, you're a right-wing kook. So I can understand why, and I'm going to make one other comment. I even wonder whether all three of you aren't in the same mindset. No offense, but I would suspect that at least the two guests are in the same mindset and just can't imagine why any progressive would be a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. Okay, I'll shut up and let you reply.
Well, thank you very much. Steve, why don't you bet first?
Well, speaking for myself, I'm fairly sure that I have a different interpretation of the Second Amendment than the caller does. At the same time, there's all sorts of progressives who have read the Second Amendment the way the caller does. So I've known this for years, and it's not new to me, so I'm not of the mindset that says that you can't be progressive and be against gun regulation.
Yeah, and I'm also just not very simply of the mindset that you can't have some position that seems not to jibe at first glance with another of your positions. I mean, part of what I complain about when I complain about mainstream media is the failure to address any kind of complexity on the part of politicians or any other human beings. I mean, that's part of my beef, is the very fact that when you're talking about Tester, you can only throw out, you know, three phrases, you know, gun control, buzz cut, you know, like, you can't.
And he's missing three fingers, don't forget that.
Okay, there you go, missing three fingers. That's what we can know. That's what we're allowed to know.
Was that
about
a gun accident?
No, it's a farm accident, I think, as a kid.
But, you know, that's all we're allowed to know about Tester, you know, so we don't even get a feeling. And I also blame media in good part for the idea that the thing that I think the caller is speaking to, the idea that we're making assumptions about other people in the country based on kind of shibboleths or litmus tests or little, you know, quick answers. And I think he's right to some extent. And I think the part of the problem is media talking about red states and blue states and people with values and people who don't have values, evidently, although that's always just implicit and not explicit, you know, and this carving people into silly little boxes. I totally agree that deprives us of the kind of conversations we ought to be able to have.
And, you know, I mean, for years, I remember the Progressive Magazine, which is published right out of Madison, for years had entertained articles by women who were anti-choice, but who were progressives. It's not being able to deal with any sort of nuance and understand the complexity of these issues is a problem. And I think the caller is not being fair. I think we're a little more sophisticated than he gives us credit for.
Our guests, Janine Jackson, Steve Rendell from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can learn more about FAIR at fair.org on the web. They are also the co-hosts and producers of Counterspin, the weekly radio program from the Media Watch Group FAIR, which can be heard right here in WILL Wednesday nights at 10:30 or on the local community station WEFT Mondays at 5:30. Before we go back to the phone line, Steve and Janine, I do want to raise another point. FAIR not only monitors the commercial mainstream news media, but also pays very careful attention to public radio and television, NPR and PBS, and has done a number of studies there. How would you... is there a discernible difference in your view between the sort of news people are going to get on NPR and PBS and what they're going to get on commercial radio and television or in their local daily newspaper?
Well, I think study after study that we've shown of NPR and of PBS, specifically All Things Considered in Morning Edition on NPR, and two different studies we've done 15 years, 16 years apart on the NewsHour, before it was called the McNeil-Lehr News Hour, now it's called the News Hour with Jim Lehr. show that it's really not that different. That
what's the sort of evidence you come up with, Steve?
Well, the same sort of reliance and the huge reliance on sort of elite sources, that is current and former government officials, including military officials, elite journalists, corporate voices. I mean, regularly we hear from corporations on things like the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, in much smaller numbers on the public, on public radio's signature news show, we hear from public interest voices. Now, if there's any place that should be featuring public interest voices, and by that I mean people who speak for people constituencies, civil rights, organized labor, the sort of things that do speak for the public, if there's anywhere where that should be showcased, it should be on public broadcasting.
Go ahead, Janine.
Well, I was just going to say, and it's not different enough in terms of who they speak to, in terms of the issues that they tackle. It's different more around the edges. And frankly, I think we remember that. It stands out to us. You see a fantastic in-depth show about another country, on a public broadcasting station. And you think, wow, this is actually more complicated and more in-depth. And I'm hearing voices that I don't think I would hear. Unfortunately, then we overlook what's the day-to-day news programming that we get from these public outlets. And there, unfortunately, it looks really a lot like mainstream media, which is not just bad because, gee, we don't need another one like that. It's bad because public broadcasting is this beautiful opportunity to have something really different, and it's falling so far short of that.
And, Republicans, one of the things that we measure is partisan guests. And on the NewsHour, in just a very recent report that we just did, a big study we did of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, we found that of partisan guests, Republicans outnumbered Democrats by 2-1, 66% to 33%. Now, what this shows to us is the same sort of preference for conservative thinking over liberal thinking or over centrist thinking, depends on how you typify the Democrats, that the corporate networks have. And this is driven by the fact that PBS really isn't public broadcasting. It's really in great ways dependent upon a Republican Congress until just recently for its money, and increasingly dependent on corporate contributors. And in the case of the NewsHour is also owned by Liberty, in majority, by Liberty Media, which is owned by John Malone, the guy who some people have called the Murdoch of the United States, even though Murdoch lives here. So you have the same sort of pressures. You have political pressures coming from Congress on public broadcasting, and you have corporate pressures coming from corporate contributors. So it's not truly public broadcasting in our view.
Well, we've got a few callers I want to get to before the show ends. But before we go back to the phone lines, I want to make a correction. I've repeatedly said that Will airs Counterspin on Wednesday nights at 10:30. It's actually Thursday nights at 10:30. And you know what, guys? I took that off the FAIR website, so you better update.
Correction for us.
Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Steve Rendell and Janine Jackson from FAIR live on the air here at WILL AM 580. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, about 10 days before the election, it was a Thursday morning, I know, on Morning Edition on NPR, there was an interview with a journalist from the Nashville Tennessean about the ad wars in the Tennessee Senate race, and it had to do with the Democrat. I can't remember his name at the moment.
Harold Ford.
Harold Ford.
Yes. whether he had voted to give the morning after pill to teenagers. And the concluding remark that the print journalist had was, well, I guess it will come down to who the voters believe. And I was driving to work, and I started yelling because it seems that there's a voting record that could be examined. And I'm wondering, in some disciplines in the humanities, there's a lot of work based on the idea that facts are socially constructed, and therefore there can't be any such thing as a fact. And we also see this general distrust or disrespect of sciences in our culture today. Is that what's happening in the media? Is that we're losing any sense that there really are facts?
Well, I don't think it's, where there may be some benefits to postmodernism, I really don't think the idea that the facts are just social constructions is a good one. Journalists are supposed to go and examine these sorts of claims, and they're supposed to come back and report on them. If you look at the Society for Professional Journalists Code, it says that's their job. But increasingly, we have people in very high levels in journalism that are saying, really, that their job is just to record the competing claims of each side. So there's no indication that that journalists are actually supposed to examine these claims and come back and tell us who's telling the truth.
Yes, it makes me scream as well. On almost a daily basis, we've had, including Jim Lehrer from the NewsHour, we've had journalists and reporters from the New York Times say, specifically with regard to George W. Bush, say, it's not within our purview, obviously I'm paraphrasing, it's not our job to say when the president is lying. You know, when people have said, well, you know, he said one thing on this day and then he said a different thing. Well, yes, but we're just going to say how it was interpreted or, you know, how Democrats might talk about it or whatever. They flat out said that many journalists have flat out said they don't see it as part of their job to call a lie a lie. And I think that's part of the problem that the caller is talking about, where it becomes, you know, one claim versus another, and it's as if there's no there. Well, of course, there are some things that are ambiguous. There are some things that have to be left to the public judgment, but there are facts. There are facts that can be reported, and I agree that there seems to be a slippage, and it distresses me the way it sort of echoes what we've heard from the W. Bush administration about, you know, We make reality. You know, you all are in the reality-based community. We make our own reality. It seems to me journalists are buying into that, and that gives me the creeps.
This is the whole Swift boat phenomenon, where journalists did not go and get to the bottom of the story. Because Kerry's camp was quiet, the journalists said, well, we can't really respond to those charges. All we can, if the Kerry camp was making noise about them, we could record their rebuttals. But it's really not our job. We found the head of political reporting at ABC has made this argument. The head of political reporting at NPR has made the argument that really they're just supposed to record what each side says. And we had that story flourish, despite the fact that on Kerry's side you had Kerry's account, the account of every person who served on his boat, plus the entire naval record, against a group of people, a political group, that none of whom served with Kerry. And that story was presented as sort of a they said, he said story, instead of journalists going and getting to the bottom of it. The story was an easy one.
You know, we've got so many callers left, and there's so much I'd like to do. I need to get you guys back for one of these 24-hour marathons, because just that Harold Ford racist ad that was aired alone could be a full show, and I'm sorry we don't have time to go more into that, but let's get back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Steve Rendell and Janine Jackson.
Good afternoon. I'm really enjoying this forum, I might add. I just find it interesting, and I disagree with the comment that public broadcasting is in line with the CBS's, et cetera. I don't agree with that. The reason why I listen to public radio and public broadcasting is because I get a different view. And I think what we as listeners, voters, Americans have to do is filter our news. I want to go back to Tester. And to me, I agree with someone that was commenting that he's not a conservative Democrat. And he's an organic farmer. Think about that. That in itself suggests that he's certainly not conservative at all. But I just think we as listeners, voters, have to filter what we hear. Because, and I know I did, much like the lady that called earlier, you hear these comments and you think, you know, I'm smarter than that. That can't be the case. But I'm enjoying this, and I can only find what I'm listening to today on public broadcasting. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. You know, in the interest of time, I'm going to go right to our next caller. Line 4, Fryna, welcome to the airways. You're on with Janine Jackson and Steve Rendell from FAIR.
Oh, thanks so much. This is a great opportunity. I agree with the earlier caller. This your radio program is my second favorite radio program. On the media program this afternoon here on this station, they reported that Rush Limbaugh has refuted the Bush administration for not being truly conservative enough, which is laughable. But how about the right wing getting in on an impeachment groundswell? And what's your thoughts on impeachment? Thank you.
You know, before you answer impeachment, because that was a call, that question was one I wanted to touch on. Steve Rendell and Janine, both of you, but Steve especially, have really monitored the political right and right-wing media. Rush Limbaugh, FAIR has monitored O'Reilly. You know, the Limbaugh caused quite a flap, Steve, as you know, by saying that, confessing that he's sort of been carrying water for Bush the last few years. He hasn't liked it because he's had to sort of say stuff he didn't believe. What's your take on, you know, the right-wing media project today? Where does it stand?
Well, I mean, I think yes, Rush was trying to be go along with the program, being a GOP organization man, which I think is he has to do somewhat fitfully. He is a very conservative guy. That's one of the great services that he gives to the Republican Party is he's to the right of them, making a lot of them appear to be a little bit more moderate than they might otherwise appear. I think I guess I wouldn't comment about the state of right-wing media right now, but what I do find interesting is that we have in our mainstream media these discussions about every little nuance of the right. Mm-hmm. Now it turns out a lot of them don't like George Bush. And of course, some people came out earlier and said that there was too big a deficit and they thought Bush was not truly conservative and all that sort of thing. But we have discussions about that. If we actually had a broader ranging media, a broader debate, we might know about all the little nuances on the left. If we actually had a liberal media, as we're told all the time, we would definitely hear about all those little schisms, but we don't. And I think the most interesting thing is that every time that a Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh has a difference with another conservative, that it's in the national media. I just find that fascinating.
Well, if I can pick up and talk about impeachment.
Yeah, please do, Janine.
I would say it's a great example of how media can talk about something and not talk about it at the same time. I'm sure someone will say, hey, you're saying media aren't giving a lot of coverage to the idea of impeachment, but I've read an article today and I read an article yesterday, so let's talk about that. I mean, Newsweek online did a story that included poll data that actually showed that 51% of the people that they polled had impeachment as a priority, as either a high or low priority. This sounded like big news to us, but Newsweek buried it at to the end of the article, and they began it. This is a pre-election article. The setup goes like this. Other parts of a potential Democratic agenda receive less support, especially calls to impeach Bush. And then here are the numbers. 47% of Democrats say that should be a top priority, but only 28% of all Americans say it should be. 23% say it should be a lower priority. So here's Newsweek. They've got a number that says 51% of the public support impeachment as either a high or low priority. And what they do with it is put it in the last paragraph of an article and use it as an example of how the Democrats are out of touch because a higher percentage or a different percentage of them think it should be a high priority. You know, it's a ridiculous burying of what ought to be the lead of a story, which is a groundswell of support for impeaching a sitting president.
And then they can say that they covered
impeachment, and someone can say to us, how dare you say they didn't cover it, because they did cover it. You know, there are ways and ways to cover an issue, and some of them speak to it while somehow saying that's not an idea that reasonable people have.
Well, on that note, Janine Jackson, Steve Rendell, I want to thank you both for being my guests today on Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Listeners interested in following up with FAIR should go to the website, www.fair.org, or listen here Thursday nights at 10:30 for Steve and Janine's program, Counterspin, that they do with Peter Hart. Again, thank you both very much for joining us, and I hope the next 20 years go well for Fairness and Action Reporting.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with Katrina Vandenhoevel from The Nation as our guest, and I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for his hard work. See you all then. Thank you very much.